and I certainly enjoyed hearing his lovely wife report on his activities, and I'm looking forward to his answer. I can't wait to hear what this rogue's got to say. Well, those bad things he did to our dear Dot. So without further ado, I'll give you John M. from Statesboro, Georgia.
My name's John Mooney, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, everybody. It's good to be here.
And I don't know, a Sunday morning spot here is a kind of a rough one after what we've had this week. And I got an old story I used to tell a long time ago. You probably all heard it, but it's kind of appropriate right now. So I'm going to tell it to you because that's the way I feel. There was a couple of little football teams down in Georgia that had a rather intense rivalry. And one time they'd played the whole season, nobody won a game. And it was the last game of the season, and one team had the ball first down on the other team's two-yard line. And the coach yelled out and says, "Give the ball to Calhoun." And they ran the play, and they didn't make a gain, and somebody else carried the ball, and the coach got a little upset. He said, next time he yells out, he says, "Give that ball to Calhoun." They ignored him, and somebody else carried the ball. They gained a yard, had a yard to go. And so he yelled out this time, "Give that ball to Calhoun," I said. And so they still ignored him, and they didn't make the gain, and it was fourth down, had about a half a yard to go. And he yelled out, he says, "Give that ball to Calhoun." And the quarterback turned around and says, "Calhoun don't want to get that ball." It's been a wonderful weekend for me. I was yet last night listening to Sybil talk about the old days, and I got to thinking about some of the things we might receive subconsciously and things that we might receive consciously, you know, and I've often thought about my first contact with AA, and really, I don't know when it was, but I know that it was before I realized it, because the earliest contact I can think was about 1953, that I'll tell you about in a moment, when I was in a place, and a guy gave me the AA book to read, in a place called Silver Hill, up in Connecticut, near New York, and I was a psychiatric patient being treated for a nervous disorder, characterized by a tendency to drink liquor and shoot dope. And so he gave me this book, and I thought he was giving it to me because he wanted me to educate me something about alcoholism, and I attached no importance to it. And I said, "This is a good book for alcoholics, and those that I find in my practice, I will give it to them." So I just forgot about it. But one day, several years ago, my youngest son, Bobby, was cleaning up the garage one day, and he found some old magazines, and he brought a magazine in to me, and he said, "Here's something I think you might like to have." And it was the March the 3rd, 1941 issue of the Saturday Evening Post with the Jackie Alexander article in it. It said on it, Dr. John Mooney, Pinehurst, North Carolina, was the address label. And I was in the military service at that time. The old 9th Division stationed at Pinehurst, North Carolina, near Fayetteville at Fort Bragg there. And for some reason, I had saved this thing. I had saved this article, this magazine, and I had no recollection of ever having seen that magazine before, but I had carried it where I was transferred to various places in the military and finally got home with it. I didn't get home with very much, but that magazine was up there. And then I looked at it, and I had often jokingly, when I was drinking, kidded people about the way to get your hand to keep your hand steady. I said, "You can take a towel and you can throw it around your neck, and you can catch the other end of the towel and your glass. And if your hand is shaking, you can pull it down like this and hold it going." And lo and behold, there's a picture of a man in that magazine doing just that. See, that's where I found it. I read that article and I had no recollection of it, but somehow or other it stuck. And I think there must have been something going on in my subconscious mind. Maybe, John, someday you will need this, but I wasn't ready at the time. My next contact with AA, as I said, was in 1953 in Silver Hill, and I did nothing about that. I went out. I went back to my trying to work and trying to drink and trying to shoot dope. And then the next contact that I recall was about 2 years before I came in AA. And I had been to many hospitals. I was going way down the line. This was about 1957. And I was sitting at home one day in my living room, drinking, drunk, watching the test pattern on TV. And God had taken the children and gone out to their mothers. And I was just sitting there, and this doorbell rang, and I went to open it, and it was a friend of mine named Henry. And Henry was a pretty bad drunk around Statesboro. I'd known him all my life. We grew up together across the street, and Henry and I were great friends, and went to school together and all that. And I'd watch Henry start drinking, and I'd watch this poor man destroy himself, and I felt very sorry for him. And I'd wanted to help him. I would have done anything to help Henry. But nobody could reach him. He was just he was stubborn about his drinking. And so he came in that day, and he was clean, and he was sober. He had on a suit, and he was sharp. And he says, "John, I just had to come talk to you." He said, "I know that over the years you worried about me, and I want to tell you that I'm sober, and that I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got a new group in town, and I've joined it, and I haven't had a drink in a long time now, and things are beginning to come back." Well, he talked about it a while, and I was very much impressed with the recovery Henry had. And so he says, "John, would you like to go to a meeting?" I said, "Henry, I certainly would, because I tell you, I think that alcoholism is a scourge. I think it's one of the worst health problems we've got in this country, and I want to help anybody that's trying to do something about it. So if you will set the meeting up, I will lecture to those people on alcoholism any time you want me to." And Henry says, "Thank you, John. I'll keep that in mind, and good to see you." And he left. My next contact with AA was in the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, where I was treated for narcotic addiction. And there's where I joined, and where it stuck, and where I began to see what was here. My trouble with this whole thing was denial. I couldn't see what was happening to me. I saw things in other people, but the little insight, nerve, whatever it is there, was paralyzed, and I wasn't able to see what was going on. And it was there for the first time that I began to take a look at myself and began to go back and see what in the world had happened throughout my life. Now, I was brought up in a family that I think it didn't drink. It was a good family. Like everybody else, good Christian family. My mother was superintendent of the junior Sunday school in the Methodist Church, and my father was often chairman of the Board of Deacons in the Baptist Church, and I was brought up in this kind of religious atmosphere. We had prayer at home at night, Bible reading frequently, and I didn't resent this thing or reject it. I just accepted it as part of my life and the fact that this is the way people live, that alcohol was a bad thing, and that kind of got the idea that decent people didn't drink. And so this is the way I came up. The first change that occurred in my life was when I was a sophomore at Emory University, about a week after my 18th birthday, when I was watching people were drinking. And I saw them having fun and laughing and at things that didn't seem to be funny. And I wonder what it is makes people feel that way. So one night at this dance in the Avondale Country Club in Decatur, in Atlanta, I took my first drink. It was corn liquor out of a tin can, and white lightning, we call it over there. And I took that drink, and it's the worst tasting stuff that I've ever put in my mouth. And so I took another one. I've often said that I was an alcoholic from the first taste of alcohol, but I said that isn't true. There was a period of about 1 minute and 45 seconds when I was a social drinker. That was the time it took to reach my brain. And I realized then that this thing had made some kind of a remarkable change in me that I had never experienced before. It picked me up on a platform of feeling I had never been on. I drifted up there. I began to dance. I had the most wonderful time and everything. I had a blackout. I kept on drinking, and they tell me I passed out. And they carried me home, put me to bed in the fraternity house, and I woke up the next morning with a hangover, and I quit. Everything I've said there is a symptom of this illness. And I think at the same time, I shut it off. I didn't want to really see what was happening. I had a bad experience with that thing, and for 6 months I never touched it again. And I did the same thing. And then something came over me. It's what you got to watch this stuff. It's good, but you got to manage it. You just can't have a drink all you want. And so I went into a period of controlled drinking that lasted for about 30 years, in which I was trying to control this thing and unable to. I would try to control it, and I would hold my drinking down, and the amazing thing was that in the beginning I did pretty well with it. I was able to most of the time, but there were times when it would flip out. I think that the history of the progression in the illness really was the fact that a loss of control over a period of years. In the beginning, pretty well able to drink when I wanted to and not get drunk, and then later on, just drinking and getting drunk every time I touched the stuff and absolutely no control. Remember, way back in my early drinking, I was at a party one night that my first wife's mother was giving, and they were teetotalers, and they didn't like drinking that in this house, and so I was having to sneak it, and I was going out in the little butler's pantry there where I had a little bottle, and I was pouring the liquor into coffee, and then drinking it, and then doing pretty well with it, I thought. Nobody knew it, I didn't think, but something happened during the evening, and I had a blackout. And I don't know what happened the latter part of the evening. Nobody ever told me, but I woke up in the middle of the night. Must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was in a cramped position, and I couldn't move. And so I kept finally stood up, and I was in the baby crib, the little deep bed they had, and it was out in the hall, upstairs hall, and I didn't have a stitch of clothes on. And I don't know how I got there, but he put me there where I put myself. But I was humiliated and embarrassed, but my friend says, "John, don't worry, you just got a little too much." There was a real red flag waving very early in my drinking career that could have told me something. But the old denial had set in, and I wasn't willing to look at it. You see, it did too much for me. I couldn't forget the pain. I couldn't let the pain teach me a lesson. And I went on with the progressive drinking for a long time, and then finally I began to get on medication. I got on drugs, I think, trying to get off alcohol. I didn't want to be a dope fiend or a drug addict, and here I became a total addict. I finally got away. I'm one of these chemically dependent people. I'd get hooked on an empty capsule if you told me it'd make me feel better. I just got to have to watch all this type of stuff. So I went to, in general, I got on it kind of like this. I had to work, you know. I needed to work. I wanted to work. But I didn't want to treat people when I was drunk. I didn't want a drunk doctor treating me, and so I didn't want to treat anybody else drunk. So I began to go down in my bag on some of these mornings when I had this bad hangover, and I came up with a drug that I had there. I had access to through my narcotic privilege. The drug is codeine. And I began to take this codeine, and the codeine worked very well. It relieved the headaches, and it gave me a little glow, and it picked me up, and it got me out of the bed and got me going, and I could get a little energy, and I could work, and you couldn't smell it. And so it worked real well, but as you know, with the codeine, the narcotics like this, the dose increases. The same dose won't work. You have to just keep adding to it, building it up. And as I built up the dose of the codeine, it increased. I ran into a side effect. I like to say this, that there's no drug that will do just what it's supposed to do, that every drug has a side effect. And so this codeine relieved my hangover feelings and gave me a little lift, but it began to make me nauseated. So I took some Bromonil and Barbital. This is a little preparation that fizzes like Salicatica that stops nausea, and it did this beautifully. But this had a side effect, too. It made me sleepy. So I took Benzedrine to wake me up. This has a side effect that made me nervous. So I took Benzedrine to calm me down. And this is what we call treating ourselves symptomatically. And this is what I was doing. Treating myself symptomatically and getting deeper and deeper into it. I'd like to announce that through this process, if you just stick with it, that you can get rid of the alcohol. You won't need the drink. And I did get rid of the alcohol, and I decided that I was really not an alcoholic. And with all this conglomeration of stuff, one day I had a convulsion. Now, I had already gone a pretty rough route with my drinking by then. I had lost my first wife through a divorce after some 10 years. I was married to Dot, and we were having a struggle, and you heard about some of this yesterday. And I was trying to function and trying to be to be a good doctor and a good father and a good husband, a good citizen, a good church man, and drink liquor. I didn't want to do these other things. I was trying to hold on to it. And in the process, somehow, I got off the liquor and I got on the drugs. And with this kind of situation, with all this medication, you finally get to where you're not sure what you are taking. You get into what I call a balanced life. You know, you've got to keep the drugs in the perfect balance or you can't function. Just bounce up somewhere or fall flat. You get the uppers and the downers confused. And it also takes away some of the little capability for automatic action that you have naturally. You know, we don't have a problem eating ordinarily, but when you're taking the drugs, I was busy. You got to watch the fork, because if you don't, you'll see it in your eye or your throat or something like that. And then they say we alcoholics have crises, and I had one night sitting in my living room. One night I had a convulsion. I don't know what all I was taking. It was a rainy night. I had to go out in the country on a house call, and I had taken some drugs to go, and I'd ridden out in the country and nearly slipped off the road, but I'd made it to the house and then gotten back. And I went in and took something else, and then the next thing I knew, I was lying on the floor, and I had this pain in the back, and I was looking up, and all these people were bending over. Dot said she was in the kitchen and heard this noise and went up, and I was just in a tremendous convulsive seizure, which was a severe one, and wound up with two fractured vertebrae. I didn't tell those people what I was taking. I got all kind of possibilities out of that. They thought I had a brain tumor, and they sent me to Atlanta where they did the electroencephalograms and all that. But they also found out there that I was hooked on drugs, that I was hooked on Demerol, because what they gave me wouldn't relieve me. And so it started the round of psychiatric hospitals. The first thing I did was to say, I'm going down and take a month off and get off this stuff. And so I went down to a place called Indian Rock Beach, below St. Petersburg in Florida. And I rented a house down there for a month, and I was going to take some codeine and get a reducing dose each day and get off of it. I took 100 tablets with me and figured that's all I'm going to need. Those tablets lasted about 2 days. I ran out. I got a bottle of liquor, and I got drunk. And then with this, there came a realization of the plight that I was in, and I decided that it was time to destroy myself, that I'd commit suicide. I was wearing a brace from this fracture I'd had on the back, and so I went down on the beach, and I wanted to kill myself, but I didn't want to do it in a messy way. I didn't have no nerve to shoot myself, and so I decided that I would swim across the Gulf of Mexico, that I could get so far out, and I couldn't get back, and I'd have to drown. And then it would think it was an accident. So I put my brace out on the beach, and I started swimming, and I swam about 10 yards, and I got thirsty. So I said, I better go back and get another drink. So so this I did. I went back, and I got another drink, and they realized something was going on, and Doc was there with our oldest boy. Was just a baby then. He was about 6 months old. And they had a maid there with us, and so they just got the car loaded up, and they hauled me back to Georgia, and I wound up in Holland Hospital in Holland, North Carolina. And this was the first of the psychiatric hospitals, and I went in there and discovered I had some bad psychiatric disorders. I discovered that I was manic depressive, and I was a psychoneurotic, and that I could not stand pressure, that I couldn't stand competition. And these were the things that were causing me to take too much alcohol and dope. And so I set out to find somebody that could help me resolve this illness that was causing me to drink too much. In other words, I started out on the secondary approach to alcoholism. And this will always result in the alcoholism being untreated. They treated my nervous disorders, but my alcoholism was not treated. And I don't know what it was. I think a lot of it was what I told these people. I didn't tell them too much about it. They wondered how much I drank. And I said, I don't drink very much. A couple of drinks for dinner, about like other people do. So it was not their fault that they didn't get the... They were not able to make the diagnosis, because I lied about this for years. But I didn't want to... I didn't want to quit drinking. I just didn't want to drink so much, and I didn't want the problem. So I set out to try to find out what it was that was causing me to drink too much so it could be remedied, and then I could go back to the kind of drinking I did in the beginning. And it was a downhill course all the way. I would go in a place, I would learn something new, Several times Dot and I would go celebrate by getting drunk over the new information I'd had about myself. One place, they found some abscess teeth, and they pulled his teeth, and I said, honey, just think about it. Those teeth been causing us trouble all these years. And she was real happy about this, too. And so we went down to Johnny Harris's in Savannah and got drunk to celebrate my recovery. And this all foolishness went on for years. But all the way for the downhill course, the illness is progressive, and each time it got worse and worse. And until the spring of 59, when things were, I was involved in a near disaster. I just tell you about one or two little things there to let you know what the situation was, especially my financial situation. One was I was in trouble with myself. I was not in any active trouble with my profession, but I was in trouble with my own organization. I couldn't get organized. I couldn't do. It seemed like that the hours of the day and night were all mixed up, and I'd find myself making routine hospital rounds at 2 o'clock in the morning and getting out of the office at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the whole morning office hours and stuff like this. It just seemed to be, it was chaos, disordered completely. And my financial affair. Now I was a doctor still treating patients, and I was going in every day and making house calls and going into the hospital and doing surgery and all this, and yet I had nothing. I couldn't pay my bills. I'll tell you about one bill that I had, a couple of them anyway, one financial thing there, and it'll give you an idea of the fix I was in. First of all, I owed the city dairy $480 for milk I couldn't pay, and they kept bringing that milk every day, and I couldn't pay this bill. But my policy on paying bills was to pay the rent. You know, back in 1938, I built the little house we lived in, and I borrowed money from the Jefferson Standard Life Insurance Company in Greensboro to build this thing. And I had a fear of my family being put out in the street. And so I kept paying on that thing every month. Every month I'd pay on it. And then finally, I'd get my other bills built up, the grocery bill, the gasoline bill, the drug bill, and all this I couldn't pay, the clothing bill. So then I'd borrow money on the house, refinance the house, and pay off the other bills. But I never missed that old monthly payment on that house because I knew if I paid that, the sheriff couldn't put them out. In 1965, after I'd been sober for 6 years, we remodeled this house, and I wrote off to the Jefferson Standard Life Insurance Company to see how much I still owed on it. And they wrote me back and said I owed $5,500. I paid off $2,000 in 28 years. So, you can see the fix I was in. In the spring of 1959, something happened to me. Now, you can call things what you want to. I think this beautiful fellowship here says we can call a spiritual experience what we want to. It says God is our understanding. A little story about three umpires that were talking about balls and strikes. And one of them says, I call them like I see them. And the other one says, I call them like they are. And the third one says, they ain't nothing till I call them. Think about that, you know, a little bit. I was riding down South Main Street in Statesboro, Georgia, as I recall it, and something happened to me. I got a feeling somewhere that I was dissatisfied. I don't want the way I'm living. I want something better. It was a desire for something better. And I see this as a spiritual experience. I didn't give myself this desire. It came from my higher power outside of myself. And I wanted something better. And I went back and talked to Dot about it. And I said, honey, I'm in a mess. I can't keep functioning. It's getting worse. I'm treading water. I'm getting nowhere. I'm working. I'm bothered. Everything's okay, and I'm getting nowhere at all. And she was having a problem, too, as she told you about. We were both just living with no communication and no success and no joy of living and nothing. You're just trying to live out each day and survive. And so I said, I had sent a patient to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital at Lexington where they treat narcotic addiction. This man was hooked on morphine, and he got better. And I think I'm going up there. And so I wrote off, and I got the application blanks, and I filled it out. I said, we've gone to places. I've been all over the United States, New York, Connecticut, Atlanta, all over Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, the psychiatric hospital, and I said, I'm getting no better. And so I want to go up there and where these people can help me, see if they can do something for me. And it didn't cost anything, too. That was a that was something that was in his favor. So I wrote off and got the information, and it sent back, and it had this big building, a brick building with some little white buildings around the edge, and it said they took prisoners, federal prisoners, who had narcotic problems and had been convicted. If they wanted treatment for their addiction, they would let them serve time there instead of in a regular prison. And that it was a federal penitentiary, but it was operated as a hospital for the treatment of addiction. And they would also take volunteers who really wanted to do something about their addiction problem. Well, I said, they put the prisoners in this big, big building, and they put the volunteers in these little white buildings around the edge. Especially a man like me, I'm a distinguished position. And these people wouldn't put me in that big brick building, so I went up there as a volunteer. The first thing he did, they took my clothes off, and they put on a little uniform with a number. The number says 58520. And I'm looking at that thing, and it didn't have any name or nothing. It didn't even have Dr. 58520. I was humiliated and embarrassed, and they put me in this place right in there with all those dope fiends off the streets of New York and over there, and there was an undisciplined crowd, and I was humiliated and embarrassed. Me, a professional man, being put up in a place like this, they can't treat me this way. This is not any way for me to get well. But I said, this thing has use. You know, I know one thing about it is, it teaches me what's going to happen to me if I keep on drinking and shooting dope. Now, I'm going to stop before I reach this point. So after a week, I signed out of there. AMA, that means against medical advice. And the doctor says, John, I wish you'd stay, because if you don't stay now, you're going to be back here inside of a year on a court order. And I thought he was nuts, because I could see right there what was going to happen to me, and I wasn't about to get involved in more alcohol or drugs with this facing me. So I went out determined that I would never, never touch alcohol or drugs again as long as I lived. And I was honest with this, I believe, because I felt better when I made this decision. I got in a little white Thunderbird I had, a little hat, little white hat I wore, and it had a red upholstery, and it had a top on it. I kind of felt like a college boy when I was riding that thing, you know. But this is one of those two-seated Thunderbirds that's a collector's item now. They got it in the Ford Museum, same model, 1956 Thunderbird. And I was riding down the road, and I was feeling real good about myself and my plans, and heading down US 25, heading back to Statesboro, Georgia. And I had to go through Knoxville, and I came to a sign that said, last chance to buy whiskey before Knoxville. And I got to thinking about myself and what I was going to do, and I said, I can't get there tonight. I got to stop and spend the night somewhere. I think I'll go by Gatlinburg. I have a friend there named Jim who lives in Gatlinburg, and Jim had told me if I was ever up that way to drop by to see him. And so I had to tell him I would, but Jim likes to drink. So I believe I'll stop here and get a little liquor, and then I'll go by, and this will make it a little easier for me to ask Jim to put up with me. So I stopped in this store, and I bought 2 fifths of Canadian Club. And I got in the car, and I headed on out toward Knoxville at the time. I went on down there, and I got to thinking some more about what a great thing I was doing and giving up liquor for the rest of my life. Well, this is a great thing, you know. And this stuff is in the past now. I never have to drink again. And I stopped at a little hamburger stand, and I ordered a hamburger and a Coca-Cola, and I got to thinking some more. And the more I thought about myself with the great sacrifice I was making and the great progress I was making, the more important it became. Well, what a great step this was. Here's a man who's thrown away half his life, and now he's made this decision never to touch it again. And a little different kind of life. Now, you can't live that life here. You got to live that life in Georgia. That's where you're licensed to practice medicine. And if you're going to do that the rest of your life, sure, there's nothing wrong with taking one more little drink today. And so I poured out a drink, and I took this drink, and it's the first drink of the last drunk I've had as of now. And it told me something. You know, you say we got a closed mouth. Then we got the rejection where we don't really know, we can't really see ourselves. And it's been that way with me. But when I took that drink, it all came through like a flash. And I knew what had happened. I knew that I couldn't quit drinking. I looked back and told myself, John, you have just taken a drink when you had sworn that never, and as long as you live, would you ever touch an alcoholic dope. And the panic set in. And it was a panic of drunk that went over 3 states. I got locked up in 3 states. It wound up in my own hometown jail. And I went down there, and I'd been obtaining drugs through illegal procedures. I had been writing prescriptions to fictitious people and riding over the country trying to get Demerol and morphine and other narcotics for myself, breaking all the Georgia laws and the federal laws doing this and getting away with it, I thought. And then this particular time, really, was strictly liquor. I didn't take any narcotics after I got out of there. But I wound up in these places, and I discovered that they had traced some of these drugs I had gotten, and I had been indicted by the grand jury. And I was called before the court, and I pled guilty to the illegal possession of a bottle of Demerol, because I knew if they kept looking, they'd find 1,000. And so I pled guilty, and the judge heard this charge in his office. And at the end of that 2 weeks, after having to get hire detectives to scour the city of Atlanta to find me in a hotel room where I was drunk, I was hauled in this office, and the judge sentenced me to 2 years in the Georgia State Prison at Reedsville, which was for a felony violation, which was a violation of my narcotic privilege. And at the end of this thing, he says, "John, I don't think you're a criminal. I think you're sick. And I'm going to give you a chance to get some help. And I will probate this sentence, provided you will go back to Lexington and stay there till they release you." I said, "Judge Renfro, I've known you all my life. I've never been in your court before. This is the first charge against me. I realize now the mess that I'm in is that I'm an addict, an alcoholic, and I can't take this thing. And why don't you give me a suspended sentence and let me show you that I don't have to have any more treatment, that it's gotten through." He looked at me and he says, "John, I don't think you heard me." He said, "You can either go to Reedsville, to the Georgia State Prison, or you can go back to Lexington." I said, "Thank you." I didn't say anything else because I knew what it was. I hated him, but not very much, because I knew that he could have set me he could have made an example out of me. So I went back up there on an airplane with a deputy sheriff on a court order, not a year, but 2 weeks after the doctor had told me that for what was going to happen. And they were taking my history, and they said, "John, how long have you been having a problem?" I said, "About 2 weeks." And I believe this, you know. I believe it was a 2 weeks problem, because that's when the things beyond my control stopped happening. You know, started happening. Before that, I'd generally been able to work my way through things. I'd argued myself out. I'd persuaded people. I had talked people into doing things for me. One doctor in New York caught up with me one time. He was kind to me, and he gave me some privileges. And I went in New York and got drunk, and I created some disturbance, and I disturbed some of his other patients, and he threw me out. And he wrote out a letter and told her that I was a constitutional psychopath. That means you're born crazy. That I couldn't tell the right from wrong, and I had no conscience, and she could either put up with me the rest of her life, or she could divorce me and marry some decent fella. And she told him, she said, "You're the first that ever found him out." And it really was. I didn't fool him, and I didn't fool these people at Lexington either. And what's more important, I wasn't fooling myself anymore. The realization came over me of the tremendous trouble I was in, and I said, "This is indeed true. I do have this schizophrenia, this paranoid schizophrenia, and I may be this constitutional psychopath." When I read that fifth chapter, it says, "Some of us can't. That has to be me." And I applied for treatment. I wanted help. And so I applied for psychiatric treatment. And they were very kind to me, and they called me in, and they gave me some 6 hours of interviews. Went all back into my history. And then they rolled off to all these hospitals and got the records. And then they called me in for a board examination. Finally, they got around and says, "John, we have checked into this for your history," and said, "We are sure, too, that you have something gravely wrong. There's something bad wrong with you way back. And whatever it is, we're not going to be able to handle it. And the length of time we can keep you here on that probated sentence. That probated sentence is for about 5 months for what we call the cure. At the end of that time, you'll have to turn you loose. But we will give you a complete psychoanalysis by a certified therapist here A psychiatrist, we will do this provided you will stay until it is completed. And that will take 1, 2, or 3 years. We don't know how long. And we don't know whether or not it will be successful then. But we will do this for you if you will take it. I have a little streak of honesty. A little bit of a flash of that truth that Dave was talking about the other night. And I knew I wouldn't do it. I knew that when I got to feeling better, I was going to get out of that place. I don't like being locked up. I never have gotten used to being in prison. And so I turned it down. And he said, well, you better go to AA, because there's nowhere else for you to go. And that's finally the way that I came to you people. And I began to think about the time I had, that book I had read, and some other things, and I knew very little about it, but I found out it was a very active organization in there. And so I joined, and I wanted to be better. You see, I'm still operating under this desire, which is a spiritual desire, I think. I think there were some things that had to happen to me before I was ready, and I think one of these things was the fierce pride that I have, that I'm something different. I felt this way. One time I'm drunk in Fort Valley, Georgia, and the preacher and his family took care of me and got me sobered up, and the preacher came to get me, and we were riding down the road, and he says, John, you know what's wrong with you? He says, you think you're something special. You think you've got special talents and special abilities other people don't have. So what you've got to realize that you ain't nobody but plain old John Looney, that you don't have anything that everybody else doesn't have. I said, preacher, I'd like to believe you, but that's just not true. He shook his head, and he knew there was going to be trouble, I think. But that's what it was. It was this pride. I went in there thinking I was something different. I went in there feeling that this was not for me, but that I was going to humble down to it, you know, because it was necessary for a while anyway, or learn from it. But after that experience when I left, of being totally unable to control myself, a panicky drunk, in which I was absolutely wild. There was no way, there was nothing happening to me that I could control. And I went back in and I realized that I was whipped, and I think some of the pride was gone, and I felt comfortable with those people, and those people I referred to as the dope fiends off the street in New York welcomed me with open arms, and we all felt as one, because I identified with them and the others in there. And that's what I needed to do, to get off this horse that I've been riding that was setting me apart from the others. So I went back, and I started going to AA, and I went to meetings, and I began to get something from it. And my sponsor, Houston S. from Frankfurt, who's dead now, used to come out there, and he told me what to do. He says, John, you can do one of two things in this place. You can sit here and resent that judge, and you can hate these people, or you can make this the most useful period of your life. You can start looking at John. You can make a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself, and I did. And I did what he said, because I believe this man. And I went in there, and I found things wrong with me. And I found the pride, and I found the disaster in my life. And I saw that I had trouble long before I went. And I went through this thing, my trouble went back from 2 weeks to 2 years, and finally it goes back to the very first contact with alcohol. And I saw myself as an alcoholic from the first drink, as one of these people who just naturally has this illness and are just waiting around for the exposure to the chemical. And that's what I am. I began to study the thing, and I still had this obsession, though, that there was something causing it, you know. And one day I was told something causing it, a nervous condition that was causing me to drink. And one day I was telling an AA member about this thing. I said, Bill, if I could only find out what it is causing me to get drunk. And he says, John, did it ever occur to you it's the whiskey causing you to get drunk? And I never thought about it this way. And that was really important to me. It was another one of those things that might not mean a lot to other people, but it had a tremendous effect on me, because it turned my thinking around. It turned my thinking around about myself, and enabled me to see the truth for the first time. I was sitting in the lounge one day, looking out through the bars at a herd of Angus cattle that were wandering loose on the hillside there. There was a little fence around this cattle that any one of them could have pushed over. And I got to thinking, now these cows out here that are going to be butchered and eaten are running loose, and they got me with all his college degrees locked up. I said, what's the reason? This thing's incredible. This should be a human being here, supposed to have an education. And I'll also admit, and yet here I am locked up. And no matter how I turned this thing around, or what I thought about it, there was only one answer that I could come up with, and that was that if I hadn't been drinking liquor and shooting dope, I wouldn't have been here. They don't put you in Lexington for being nervous. And this had great meaning to me. Because, you see, I've been trying to make of alcoholism a secondary illness. I began to see myself as suffering from some sort of deep-down disturbance that was causing me to drink. And for the first time, I began to look directly at the alcohol and what it had done. And I came up with the answers that I'm giving you this morning. I've been suffering from untreated alcoholism all along because I was turning away from it, rejecting it. And I began to see things about me. And as I go on now through the years and try to keep this same attitude of honesty toward myself, if I can maintain it, I get a feeling that I learn more truth in, about the illness. And I'm comfortable with what happens. The situation I was in when I was treating this thing as a secondary illness was discomfort and trouble and progression and things getting worse all the time. And since I've treated it in myself as a primary illness and set out, first of all, to stay off the chemicals. And I began to realize, like you said, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a program to keep you from drinking. It's a program of recovery that will work for you, provided you don't drink. And this is that leaving off the alcohol is not an objective of the AA program, it is a condition. And I began to see it this way. These people can't make me quit drinking. I was looking for the magic guy that was going to close the bottle off on me so I couldn't drink no more. But I discovered through this I will always have this privilege. It's drinking is a responsible act, you know. You take a glass, and you take a bottle, and you pour some liquor in that glass, and you swallow it. And that's a responsible act, and you can't put it on nobody else. You can't say anybody else made you do it. Your program of survival, they said, is a responsible act. You go to a meeting, you stay sober. You try to do this on your own, you probably won't. So your objective is to try to get to the meetings. This is what you try to do, and try not to drink while you're doing it. And then let the program work for you. That the program will work, provided you can stay out of these chemicals. Of course, I'm a chemical-dependent person in many different ways, and so with me, it has to be more than just the alcohol. I've got to stay out of all this stuff, which is not too difficult, by the way. But anyway, I learned about the basic truth about the illness. And yet I said, how am I going to do this thing? So what's going to happen? And I went back to my experience as a in church and all this sort of thing, and I compared that with the spiritual steps of this thing, and I kind of smeared over these spiritual steps because I felt like the kind of upbringing I had and the commitment I had to spiritual things and religion in my home was meant that I had this all along. This is one of the part of the thing that I felt like I had was a spiritual part of the program, and so I just kind of slipped over it. And so as the time came closer for me to leave, I began to get distressed because I had checked out everything that happened in my inventory. Told me that every time I'd ever been in a place and had been determined I wasn't going to drink, that I got drunk almost immediately after I left. Except for one occasion, I got drunk immediately. And so I said, "What's going to happen now? I'm going to get drunk as soon as I leave this thing." And I began to think about a friend I had at Bowling Green. You know, I think I'll go over and see Kit. He and I used to drink together and have one more drunk in Bowling Green before I go back home to Statesboro and stay sober from now on. And that scared me. Because, gosh, this will be, if I drink again, I'm going to die. And so I was disturbed about this thing. And I guess my sponsor realized this, that I was there. I was losing sleep. I wasn't looking good. And at this time, it's interesting. A friend of mine who is an artist in Lexington now was in there with me at the time. Drew a picture of me. I asked him I told him I wanted to get a little sketch of me out of this as a souvenir, and he drew this picture of me. And when I looked at it, all that tension and anxiety and fear was reflected in there, and it did him so bad when I saw it that I tore the picture up and threw it away. That was building up in me at the time. I showed him, I said, "Do you see that fear?" He said, "No, it's pretty good to me. It looks just like you." But I did. It was there. I threw it away, and then my sponsor realized this, I think, because
The 3 days before I was supposed to be discharged, he arranged for two of us to go to an outside meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Old Token Club in downtown Lexington. Some of you here may be familiar with that place. And I went. And it was my first AA meeting on the outside. Inside, you know, you use it for everything except staying sober because we couldn't get any alcohol in there anyway without drugs without dire consequences. And so I went to this meeting. About 25 or 30 people, just about like you. They were laughing, they were joking. I kind of slipped in. I went around to the back by myself and was wondering whether or not they were going to accept me, whether or not that I was worthy to be there, you know. I was a convicted felon, and I was a narcotic addict, along with being an alcoholic. But these people came up to me and they put their arms around me, and everything they showed to me spelled forgiveness. They had the attitude. We don't care who you are, where you've been, or what you've done. We love you, and we forgive you. And this is a spiritual experience I had there as I began to feel uplifted by this and began to realize that there was some power in that group that I was not familiar with. I think it's where I began to take the second step, began to realize there was a power there that had helped them that could help me. And it gave me the strength to leave that hospital 3 days later, which I did. I didn't much want to go. I was scared. I had a feeling that I don't think I can make it, but I said, I'm going back, I'm going to join AA. And so I left 3 days later, very much frightened, and I remember when I got to the airport, just being out in crowds disturbed me. I felt fear just being out among people, and I went and stood in the restroom till the plane was called, and I got on the plane and I left, and I had this feeling on the plane that I've got to go back and show the people in Statesboro that I can stay sober. I had this feeling of a commitment to a cause, as I see it now, that this idea of having to prove to folks that I could stay sober down there is a reaction of pride. It's a product of my pride. And when I got to Atlanta to change planes to get the last lap to Savannah, where Doc was waiting for me, I was going to be, I didn't have enough pride left to go up the flights of that, the steps of that plane, and I gave my ticket away. And I wound up in a motel room after wandering kind of aimlessly about the airport for several hours, and then went into a depression and realized that here, when I've been through a treatment program, I've completed it like they said, done everything they said, I'm off alcohol, I'm off drugs, and now this, I can't function. I can't make myself do something that I know has to be done. And I thought about leaving, getting a ticket and going, just disappearing. And then I thought about suicide, and I came the closest to it I ever have. I looked out of the window, and I said, it'll be so easy just to go out of this on your head, and then that will end it all. But I didn't do this. As the depression got worse, I went over to the bed, and I dropped down on my knees, and I said, God, help me. And I didn't have any faith or hope. I don't think that God would. But when I had said those words, I had an instant feeling of something happening around me. The fear went away. The terror went away. The tension, I began to be lifted up on a feeling of euphoria and ecstasy, just like I'd had a drink or a shot of dope or something. It just far transcended anything I'd ever had before. A tremendous feeling. I don't know what it might call it. A psychiatrist might call it something. A biochemist might call it some type of hormone reaction, but I call it a spiritual experience because the program tells me I can call it what I want to. It ain't nothing till I call it. And so that's what I do. And that's what I do. So I had this feeling, and when I did, the fear went away, and then the realization that I can do this thing. And the realization of some other things, too, because the feeling I got from this experience was just like the feeling I got from drinking, except that it transcended. And then later I've heard other people comment on this. I heard Bob down in Texas say it's like a marshmallow. He says you put the marshmallow in the fire and said it just when it turns brown and is ready to eat, it catches on fire and burns up. And Chuck C. out in California calls it the almost disease. It almost gives us what we're looking for, but not quite. And that's what it did. The liquor almost gave me what I wanted. Almost gave me what I wanted, so I had to take one more drink because it wasn't quite there. And then before it came through, I passed out. Woke up miserable. But in the room that night, I had the fulfillment of that feeling. And since then, that was in November 1959, I've never had the craving or had to fight this craving for a drink. Now, I won't say I happen to desire to drink. That wouldn't be the truth.
But I hear people talking about having to fight alcohol day after day and year after year. That has been spared me, and I'm grateful for it, because I think the fight was gone. I don't think I could do it if I had to do it. I slept that night like a baby, the first night's sleep I'd had. I had a feeling of a kind of a partnership with God, that now, look, God can do these things for me that I couldn't do for myself. I had to make a decision about drugs. What's a safe drug for me and what's a non-safe drug for me? And I couldn't find any drug that was safe. And then the thought occurs to me from the program, says, John, why are you trying to make a decision? Do you need something now? And I says, no. I don't need anything now, not even an aspirin tablet. So, okay, well, where do you need something? So I go 12 years, and I don't even take any aspirin because I really don't need it much. And I go around to AA meetings, and I talk about my sobriety and that I don't take any aspirin. And then one night after a meeting, a guy came up to see me, and he was drunk. He says, Doc, you sure have helped me. He says, I'm still drinking a little liquor, but I ain't taking no aspirin. So I haven't said much about aspirin since then. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I got a very painful illness, and I took 6 aspirin tablets, and a friend of mine from Miami called me up and said, I heard you had a slip. But anyway, I came back. Dot met me at the plane the next day, and I came back home. And I came back, you know, you talk about the denial of the illness of alcoholism. But then you hear the denial, too, about recovery. Especially the type that makes you feel like you're well when you're not, you know. When you go in like the fellow that sees the parade and thinks he's seen the circus. Or when you, story some one member used to tell, which was very good, I think. And the fact that I go down, back down there, and I've been going to AA, and I no sooner have this little thing I call a spiritual experience, so I begin to get a feeling, by golly, you know, I've got something that can help the group down there. I'll go down there in Statesboro and see what, maybe, and I'll join this group, and I'll tell them about my spiritual experience, and by golly, you know, this may really get something across to some of them. And I was feeling this way. But first, I've got some other things to do. My family's in trouble with money, and I've got to get my practice back together. And as soon as I get a chance, I'm going to really get active and put a lot of time in the AA group there. My sponsor had told me before I left that he went to 6 or 7 meetings a week. And my reaction to that was, I didn't tell him this, but my feeling that I had when he said, boy, that's great. This old man's retired, and he can go to AA 2 or 3 times a day. And I think that's wonderful. That's what I'd like to do. But I'm going to be awfully busy trying to get my practice going again, feeding my family. And I'm going to go to lots of AA. I'm going to make a meeting every month anyway, until such time as I get things in order when I can go. And now, with this spiritual experience I had thought, gosh, I found God now. I don't really need that program in the same way. All of a sudden, all of the spiritual steps mean something to me, and I try to take them. I say, I've taken the third step. So I enter down there in an extremely hazardous state without knowing it. Extremely hazardous denial and a state of mind that I'm comfortable with because I felt so good, but all the tension and the fear is gone, and you go around with a kind of a glow on, just like the spiritual glow, high on life, they call it, where you feel like you had a drink or something. And this is great. It's a great experience, and I don't want to set it short, but it ain't enough for a guy like me. And thank God there were some other things happened at that time to bring about some completeness in my program, because this would have been a half program based on spiritual feelings or emotional feelings or something, and I don't think it would have succeeded. I think I'd have been dead. About the time I got my office appointment set up and ready to go, I was called to Atlanta to appear before the State Board of Medical Examiners, and they said, Dr. Mooney, you have been convicted of a felony. You cannot practice medicine with that on your record, and they revoked my license to practice medicine in Georgia. Now, I can't do nothing to practice medicine. I'm just a one-track guy. That's where my training's been. And I was miserable in thinking about this sort of thing. They said, you can apply for reinstatement in 6 months, and we will consider it. But there are no promises about this thing. I left that place very much disturbed and worried. And yet somehow or other, I had enough AA in me to realize something you had told me back in the spiritual part about this program. There's no such thing as something that's all bad. So there's something good about it somewhere. Maybe it'll come to you. When I came back, I let my nurse go and close the office except to try to collect some old accounts. And then I sat down in my chair and I got to thinking. And the first thing that popped in my mind was Henry. And the bandit had been to see me 2 years before. And he was the only man I knew in AA. And I called Henry and told him that I wasn't going to be very busy for a while. And I thought I was going to go ahead and join AA. And I'd like to know when the next meeting was. Well, Henry was around that office in 5 minutes. And he said, it's tomorrow night. And so I said, okay. He said, we're going to Savannah tonight. Would you like to go? I said, no, Henry, I can't take a trip to Savannah. That's 50 miles. It's short notice. I got other things to do. I have a damn thing to do. But it just did me. You got this negative attitude. You just don't do things like that. But I went the next night, and Doc went with me. There were about 15 people there, and they asked me to talk. And that was a great thing. That was a tremendous thing. I know now that they asked me to talk because they might not have found out some things about me if they hadn't had a chance to listen to me. So I got up and I talked 15 minutes on the rehabilitation program in Lexington, and they told me later it's the worst AA talk ever been made in Georgia. But you know, there's somewhere in the Bible it says there was a man sent from God. And in that meeting that night were some people sent from God. And they were listening. And these people had knowledge. And they had the magic. And they knew instantly what was wrong. They knew that I was not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they set out to enlist us. And so... After the meeting was over, one of them was C.D., and some of you know C.D., he's been up here in a number of different places, and his wife Ida. And C.D. wears a little hat. He wears a hat everywhere, and at that time he smoked a cigar. And he came up after the meeting and said, what you all doing after the meeting? Nothing. Come around the house. Went around there, and they played a tape for us, and they talked, and one of the first ones I'd ever heard, it was the first one. And they talked to us till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. We went home, and they said, what you doing tomorrow night? Nothing. We'll pick you up 7 o'clock. We're going to Augusta. Boy, they were around there in a little Vauxhall automobile, and wham, we were gone to Augusta. What you doing tomorrow night when they came in? Nothing. Okay, we're going to Savannah. Pick you up at 7 o'clock. So wham, we're off to Savannah. And this is the way it goes. And it goes this way for days and days and days. And I began to get the feeling of what's going on in this fellowship. I get the feeling of what's going on with the people. And I began to get a feeling of belonging with you. These are my people. I'm beginning to see, really for the first time, what the experience of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is. And we go along with this thing. And we keep going. And we meet dozens and dozens of people, hundreds of people. And we go to retreats. And then didn't go to any conventions at that time. Retreats came a little later. But during that time, it was mostly area meetings, we call them. And I began to get this feeling that I'm in the right place. But see, we were going every day. And after several months, I began to get the feeling that I was getting too much, that it was crowding in on me. I don't know if you've ever felt this way or not, but you get so much, it comes so fast, you begin to feel like you're backed in a corner. Now, you know what? I'd like to get out of this a little bit so that I can assimilate what I've heard. And then one morning, I'm sitting down in a drugstore downtown in Statesboro, and I'm talking to another fella who came in about the same time we did, and he's been going on these jaunts with us. And he says, he begins to voice the things that I've been feeling. He says, John, you know, I said, damn much AA. He said, it's just flooding in on me everywhere. He said, you know, C.D. and Ida are fanatics. I said, yeah, they sure are. He said, there's something worse than being drunk. I said, yeah, they sure is. Said, they don't do nothing but stay with AA all the time. That's all they have. They don't have time for nothing else. I said, you know, I'd like to have a time for a little something else. And he said, He said, I'm just flooded with it. He said, it's just running out of my ears. And I said, by golly, it's running out of my ears too. And so I said, he's right. You know, this thing can run us. You know, it can be too much of a good thing. So I went home that night, and the group was going to Dublin to a meeting. And I went home that night, and I stretched out on the bed and turned on the television set. And my idea was that I'd just cancel that meeting and stayed in and watched television. So I told Dot, I said, honey, I haven't seen Gunsmoke in weeks. And I haven't seen the news. And so I think I'll stay here tonight, took my shoes off, stretch out on the bed, stay here tonight, and just relax. And I expected her to do the same thing. I expected her to agree with me. Sure, you know, just the way I feel, we'll just take off tonight and tell these folks we can't go with them. But she don't do that. She was standing in front of the mirror putting on her earrings. She says, you can stay on that bed if you want to, but I'm going to Dublin with those people. And I got up like a little puppy dog and put on my shoes. And I went to Dublin with her and those people. And we came back, had a good meeting. We came back, and the next morning, somebody called me and said, did you hear about Bill last night? Bill was the guy I was calling in the drugstore. I said, Bill got drunk. And I was horrified. What? And so I got to thinking about the thing and what we had said and the feeling of being crowded in on it. And then one thing he said got through to me instantly, that when AA is running out your ear, it ain't getting to your brain. And and this was a lesson from it. So at a time since then, when I've had this feeling that I've getting too much of you, I look to me. What's the rejection? What's building up? What are the resentments? You know, what's going on inside? And these resentments that I've had, you know, they work right along with the pride, and I can get them mighty easy. It's one of the terrible things. I feel like resentments and character defects. This is my feeling. Now, don't really leave me. I kind of hold on to them, and I've still got them around. At least I got the door open where they can come back. If they are taken away, I said, I'll leave some kind of an open door or window or something where they can drift in again, because they keep coming back. I compare it to a muddy water in a test tube. You know, you put the water in a centrifuge and spin it down, and you take the tube out, and there it is, crystal clear. But down at the bottom is that mud. And if you put it in your pocket and carry it around, it's all muddy again. I think you have to get rid of these things at depth and be on the guard for them. Especially resentment. I don't think you can talk yourself out of it as a resentment. I think it has to be some real change that goes on. I know I heard a little story one time that I'll share with you now about resentments that illustrates what I mean. There was a guy doing time in prison. He'd been doing this prison term for 10 years. And he was coming up for parole. And he had a resentment against society. And so the parole board says, Joe, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get out of here? The first thing I'm going to do when I got here, I'm going to get me a rubber band, make me a slingshot, give me a pile of rocks, and break every window in this building out. Joe, you ain't ready to go. You can't go back to society with an attitude like that. So they send him that. Next year, 11 years, he comes up again. Joe, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get out of here? I'm going to get a rubber band, make me a slingshot, get me a pile of rocks, and break every window in this building. Joe, you ain't ready to go. Go think this thing over. Work on your resentments here, you know. Try to accept the establishment. So he goes back, and his 12 years coming up. And so his friends got to talking to him. They said, look, Joe, you're coming up again now. You've got this resentment. Now, let's talk it over and see if you can't do something to get out of here. He said, what's the one thing a man's going to want when he's been locked up in jail with men for 12 years? Isn't it going to be a woman? Don't you think that you'd be, if you went up there and told them that you'd had arrangements to have some feminine contact when you got out of here, that they might let you go? And he said, by God, that's a good idea. So he goes up and pulls the board, and the board says, Joe, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get out of here? Joe says, I'm glad you asked me that question. Because I've been writing with this girl, and she sent me her picture, and I sent mine, and said, she's going to meet me at the gate, and we're going up to her house on the hill, and said, boy, we're going to have a party. He says, I'm going to take her out in the backyard, I'm going to take a dress off, I'm going to take a brazier on, I'm going to take her panties off, and I'm going to take a rubber band out of those panties, make me a slingshot, give me a pile of rocks, and I'll get a wonder in the building out. You know, Dave Cook and I were tremendously impressed by the same talk. And this was a talk that Tom P. from New York made it in April 1961 at Blackstone. And I got to refer to it, too, because it's one of the talks that straightened out some things for me. And Dave mentioned some of the things last night, and both of us have talked about this over the years, various places. But it's one of the things that let me know what happened to me, you know. I came out of that place in Lexington, and I came out, I had the spiritual experience, and I felt like that was all I needed. And then I lost my license, and during the 6 months that I lost the license, I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in June 19, 1960, I went before the medical board in Atlanta, and they restored my license to practice medicine without reservation. It took about 3 minutes. They said, "John, we've been keeping up with you. You're doing a tremendous job. We're proud of you. Keep at it." And so I got it back, and it was, I didn't know why this would happen. I couldn't see why it was necessary for me to lose the license, because I felt like that I was well when I came out of Lexington, but I wasn't. And then in 61, when Tom made this talk up there, suddenly it all becomes clear to me. He said there are two miracles in recovery. One is a quick miracle, which is a spiritual change of some sort. That's what happened to me in that motel room, the quick miracle. And he says, this is a quick one, but it's not enough. It's just part of it. And he says, the other miracle is the miracle of returning sanity that takes a long time. And then it was clear what had to happen. And I didn't know this. God knew this. And these people that were sent into our lives at that time, everything from the judge, even to the lawyer. You see, if the lawyer had had my license revoked before I went up there, I would have only had a month to serve when I got out. And I asked him why. He says, "John, I don't know. I just forgot it. I just overlooked it. I'm sorry." And I've told this lawyer many times, thank God that you didn't think that, because a month would not have been enough. You could have revoked the license when I went in, and then I'd only had a month to serve. And the board was trying to give it to me. The doctor was saying, "Look, he's doing fine." And there was an old legal counsel that was sat there during that meeting when they took that license away. And he sat there and he scowled at the floor. And he was a lawyer that tries to keep the doctors on the right track when they're dealing with medical legal subjects. And he says, "Gentlemen, the laws of the state of Georgia state that when a doctor has been convicted of a felony, you must revoke his license for 6 months." And then he'd argue, "Well, why can't he practice with some other doctor for a while?" "Gentlemen, the laws of the state of Georgia state that when a doctor has been convicted of a felony, he must revoke his license." And I said, "If that SOB would shut up, they'd give it back to him." See? But he don't do it. And he said, "You got to take it for 6 months." And he says, "The best time to take it is right now." He says, "He'll never miss it more." He's been out of practice. And says, "Later on, you take it after he's back in practice, it'll cause more trouble." So they reluctantly took it. And I think had it been just a month, they would have given it back to me. But thank God for that 6 months. It saved my life. And these are the work of God. God working through people and giving a whole plan, a whole mosaic of plan of recovery that I was not aware of, that Dot wasn't aware of, that none of my friends, anything else. Everybody was reacting to what was happening. And I look back over it, perfect. Perfect plan. Far better. At the end of June, when I got back in practice, I was going to 6 and 7 meetings a week. You see, I turned it around. When I came out of Lexington, I was going to go to AA as much as my practice would let me go. And then when I had no practice and I went to AA and found out, as we say, got a little bit of the sanity back and found out that I really had no program for daily living at all, that I hadn't even touched this program as far as my daily life was concerned. And then at the end of 6 months, I realized that I could practice all the medicine that AA would let me go to. That I had to put the AA first, and that was just that simple. And it's been that way ever since. And I don't think I've had a serious problem with other things interfering with Alcoholics Anonymous in my life since then. I have one thing that tries to interfere, and if there are any professionals in this room, I'd like to share this with you, that professional work with an alcoholic is hazardous activity for an alcoholic. And if you are a member of AA, and if you are a counseling alcoholic professionally, you better go to more AA than you'd go to if you didn't. As I see it, I do this, and my professional work tears down my sobriety. It doesn't build it up. Therefore, I need to be at places like I'm here this weekend. I'm working for me this weekend to try to get something back in mind. In my life, it will help me carry on the things that I feel that I need to do. And I think if we keep it in proper perspective, I think this applies not only to professional, I think it applies to general service work. I don't think general service is AA work. I think we either hold these positions sometime with that it's really not AA, it's something that's different, and we need to go to more AA in order to maintain that. And so I feel this way about anything that gets away from these 12 steps, you know. It's a simple program, and I got this simple program. I got it now, and I'm sober with it, and I don't want to mix it up. I'm a guy that'll complicate this thing if I can, and I have to keep it simple. I don't see a lot of difference between what the alcohol and the drugs do for us. And I think that the drugs are hazardous, and I always got to put in my pitch, let's try to keep ourselves chemically clean if we want to have the best program. Some people have to have drugs, I know that, but most of us don't. In 1960, I never took any benzodiazepines. That's the newest tranquilizers, like Librium and Valium and all these things. They're all the same type of drugs. I never took any of these, but in 1960, I picked up a magazine, and there was an advertisement for Librium in there, and it said, this drug will do four things for you. It says it will relieve tension and anxiety. It will impart a sense of well-being. It will promote restful sleep, and it will improve interpersonal relationships. Now, you throw in a little good food and sex, and you've got the good life, haven't you? I mean, you got everything we want out of life. I mean, this is it. Now, what did alcohol do for me? It relieved my tension and anxiety. It imparted a sense of well-being. It promoted restful sleep, and it improved interpersonal relationships. I got along fine with other people when I was drinking most of the time, up to a certain point anyway. And then what do we have to do? As long as we seek these things chemically, I don't think we're going to find them spiritually. And this was my experience anyway. I didn't believe it could happen when I came in. I didn't think there was any way in the world that a psychological program could take the place of the chemicals. And so I doubted. But they told me that when you doubt, stay sober and keep thinking about it, you know. And I went through, I think, kind of three stages. I think through a stage of tolerance, in which I said, well, I can't exist. I'm never going to ever have the real joy of feeling a gold drink go down again. But I can tolerate this. I had enough of them. I can accept it. And through acceptance, I found out that it can be done without too much trouble. And then gradually over a period of years, there has come in, and especially with this little thing that happened in the airport that night, there's come a feeling of gratitude that I found far more in the program than I ever found in a bottle or a needle or a pill or a tablet. It's one of the great things that this thing program works. It really works. I feel like that now this is something for me, and it is the program, and I don't need to complicate it in any way. I'm kind of like the soldier back in World War II that was suddenly in the middle of the battle. He got up and he started wandering around the battlefield with a machine gun going around him, and he'd pick up this little cigarette butt and say, that's not it. He'd pick up this little stick, that's not it. And they rushed out and they got him and they took him back to a hospital, and he picked up a trash can and began to throw the trash on the floor and pull out a cigarette packet, that's not it. Pull out a piece of Kleenex, that's not it. And they finally took him back to the base in the U.S. in the psychiatric hospital, and they gave him kind of tests, and everywhere he went, he took the test, you know, and threw it on the floor and said, that's not it. So finally they declared him to have mental disease, and they discharged him, and they handed him his discharge papers, and he says, that's it. When I came back, I said, that's it. That's it for me. Because once the simplicity of this thing and the love and the feeling that you people have, I got a couple of little stories to tell you, and then I'm going to be through. I had trouble with the spiritual thing, as I told you. And one time I'm sitting in a psychiatrist's office down in Florida, and this guy is looking at me, and finally he says, John, what do you want? I said, oh, I want to be a good father, good husband, good citizen, good church man. He said, are you a Christian? I said, sure, I'm a Christian. Remember Pittman Park Methodist Church? Don't own a dime out there. Paid up. And he said, do you know how a Christian would answer that question? I said, how? A Christian would say, I want to please God. And my reaction was, if anybody ever asks me the question again, I'll know the answer. And sure enough, in Lexington, they asked me a sentence completion. I said, what do you want, sir? I said, it's to please God, like any fool ought to know that. You know, this is the way it was. I got it up here on the outside, maybe, but no feeling inside. You came in through the third step, where you asked me to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. Showed me what this man was trying to tell me, that it had to be the motivating influence in my life. Another thing I had to hang up with was love. I couldn't tell you I loved you. I had reservations about this thing. I did. And one time, I'm sitting in a psychiatrist's office in Atlanta, and this is a kind of an analyst. You know, different kind of psychiatrist, you know, if you don't know much about them.
You have some that will ask leading questions to draw you out. You have others will give you platitudes and things of this. But you've got a group called analysts that don't do nothing but sit and stare. And these guys will stare at you, and he was staring at me. Now, they take special training in this, so never try to stare down a psychiatrist. You can't do it. There's no case on record of anybody being able to make a psychiatrist blink first. And so I was trying to do this without any success, and you could see the whites of his eyes around the iris, and I was looking at him, and I'm getting disturbed because ain't nobody saying anything. And I get to worried about the thing, and so I finally, he just leans forward to me, and he said, "I love you." And I'm alone with this man, and I'm happily married. And I don't have this variation in my life, so I don't think at all. And so I got up and got out of there, you know. I joined AA before I found out what this man was trying to do. He was trying to find out what the word love meant to me. And he did. Because I got left so quick. I didn't find out until I got to you. You let me know that love is the thing that makes this thing work, you know. It's the love of God reflecting through people that has us here today, that has this feeling in the room right now, that's been here this whole weekend, for me, a tremendous thing that's been here, that you're imparting to me and that I'm trying to receive and give back to you, a love and understanding between people that know what life's all about. And that's the way I feel here in this group, that the people in this fellowship are those that know what life's all about. We know this is God's world. It's not men's world. We're trying to get in tune with it. A sense of mission, a sense of purpose, a sense of feeling that everything is going to be all right no matter what happens, you know? That we're on a road. As Sybil said last night, we're in school, you know? And this is a feeling I get. And my heart just swells up with gratitude to know that I'm a part of you, and I want to keep being that way. Thank you, and God bless you.
John, on behalf of the committee, I'd like to present this gift to you.
Thank you.
We have a couple of things, a couple of pieces of...
I'm Miller John, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm on the committee here. I want to thank you all for your contribution last night for the GSO. And I have a check here for $495 that will be mailed, or that will be taken to New York by Al Farley, our state delegate. Al, will you come and get this check, please? The next roundup will be October 5, 6, and 7. And the mailing for this will be on September the 4th. The fee or price shall again be $35. We've tried to show you that we love you, and I hope you love us. See you in 180 days.
Thank you, John. Been a beautiful weekend. I just hate to leave, but I know I've got to. I want to tell each and every one of you that I love you, and I'm looking forward to my next roundup. And for those who will, please, let's stand and say the Lord's Prayer and join hands.